Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. 10 years ago, Naomi Klein became a kind of overnight hero to the feisty in-the-streets armies of the anti-globalization movement with her book, No Logo. It described and decried how global corporations were hollowing out manufacturing at home, building low-wage empires abroad, and wrapping it all in feel-good, high-concept brands and marketing that hid the truth. A decade on, she's back for another look, including at the brand she says is now the world's biggest, Barack Obama. This hour on Point, Naomi Klein, and No Logo at 10. You can join the conversation. Was No Logo your movement Bible? After 10 years into financial meltdown, are we clearer on what's going on with the world economy? Is Naomi Klein? You can also comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at onpointradio. Joining me now from Toronto is Naomi Klein, author and columnist whose fiery critiques of capitalism and war and politics have made her both hero and lightning rod. She writes for The Nation and The Guardian. She's a leading critic of globalization, corporate culture, and Western political economy. Her book, The Shock Doctrine, The Rise of Disaster Capitalism, got a lot of attention and pushback for saying that global capitalism was so unpalatable that disasters were used to push it. In 2000, she came out with her first book, No Logo, taking aim at the brand bullies. It's now out in a new 10th anniversary edition with a big new intro. Naomi Klein, welcome to On Point. Great to have you.
Thanks, Tom. Good to be with you.
This is a big intro you slammed on the front of this, and very interesting indeed. Takes us over a lot of terrain over those 10 years. And you start out with, right off, a couple of anecdotes of companies that seem to have almost taken your No Logo recipe and run with it themselves.
The two examples I chose to start with were just happening while I was writing this new introduction. One was the news that Starbucks had opened what was being called its first stealth coffee shop, which is they closed one of their branded coffee shops in Seattle and reopened it, made to look like a independently owned coffee shop. And it was very hard to even find any trace of the Starbucks logo. So they were really trying to make their brand disappear. And there were some really hilarious stories around this of Starbucks researchers going into local coffee shops in Seattle with clipboards and just taking notes about all the sort of like quirky idiosyncrasies of, you know, the bulletin boards and
non-corporate coffee shops.
And then taking those ideas and putting it into their disguised no logo Starbucks outlet. And then the other thing that happened just as I was writing the new introduction was that Absolut Vodka put out an Absolut no label edition of their famous bottle with, you know, no logo whatsoever. So I start off with those examples.
They said with that, for the first time we dare to face the world completely naked, and that it's the inside that really matters. I mean, in a way, I mean, you put them right up front, but in a way it sounds like they've gone to school on you. So what's happened to branding?
Well, look, when I wrote No Logo, this sort of thing was already happening. I have several chapters of the book about the co-optation of the critique of marketing being absorbed by marketing. And this is a pretty old trick, that really started during the 60s counterculture when marketers were wanting to sell their products to an increasingly anti-corporate consumer base.
Coca-Cola just wanted to teach the world to sing in perfect harmony.
Exactly, yeah. Exactly. So this is something of an old trick. And the co-optation of the, I mean, it's complicated because I have a chapter in No Logo about the phenomenon of young people doing what used to be called ad busting or culture jamming, using their knowledge of technology to mimic corporate advertising, but send an anti-marketing message with their anti-ads. Mm-hmm. There's a whole magazine, Adbuster, devoted to these anti-ad advertisements. So when I was writing the book 10 years ago, I wanted the title of the book and the cover of the book to itself be a culture jam, to be an anti-logo logo. So the idea of calling the book No Logo was a wink from the start. And I actually worked with I was lucky enough to work with a top-notch brand manager named Bruce Mao, who's one of the most famous designers in the world, who designed the No Logo logo, and it's very elegant. You know, it's this black cover with just the white and the red logo. So immediately,
pretty good logo.
It's a very good logo, and that was our idea, was that the title of the book would be a culture jam of a No Logo logo. But of course, immediately that was absorbed by the world of marketing, and there was a No Logo lines of clothing, food products. I was one time just walking down the street in Geneva, actually quite recently, walking down the street looking for a place to eat, and I looked in the window and found myself looking at a No Logo restaurant using the exact typeface as I have on the cover of No Logo. So
you remind
us, I predicted this in the book.
Right, you resisted copywriting it, though you say you learned over the following decade that if you had chosen to, not only might you have made money off your No Logo logo, but you could even have made money as a kind of what you called it, anti-corporate dominatrix. That you got a big critique here, and we'll look at it, but it was... What half alluring maybe to the devil in you to go out and just give this lecture to corporate executives who wanted to hear themselves thrashed?
Yeah, I definitely could have made some money going around telling corporations what bad brands they are. And once again, I mean, I kind of knew that there was always a risk that this would happen, because this is exactly what I was writing about, this the quest for the new thing, always the cutting edge, absolutely extends to the critique of corporations. I mean, there's nothing that cutting edge advertisers like more than being so cutting edge that they absorb the critique of themselves in their work and absorb the critics into their machinery. So I got lots of invitations to come and lecture at advertising firms, or even companies like Shell asking me to come and talk. And I just had a blanket policy from the start that I wouldn't do any consulting work whatsoever. I'm a journalist. I'm a reporter. And everything I have to say, I say publicly. And if they're interested in it, they can read the book. And absolutely, some marketers certainly got ideas for campaigns from reading the book. But I didn't do any consultancy. And I didn't trademark the No Logo logo, which meant that all these people could use it to for their spinoff lines, which was fine with me, frankly, because I wanted. To send this out into the culture, and it had there were things that happened with it that I loved, and there were things that happened with it that I didn't love so much. But probably the height of irony arrived when I got a lawyer's letter from a clothing company that had gone and trademarked the No Logo logo after the book was published, and mimicking the typeface, and wanted to sue me for copyright infringement because I hadn't
trademarked it yourself.
And I guess I had all of this coming to me, you know, but it was quite a wild ride, actually.
There's so much to talk about here, including you spend a good deal of time in your new intro on the brand Obama, and by no means with unadulterated admiration for that brand and what it turns out stands behind it. But just big picture, in these 10 years, I mean, you became a kind of icon yourself on those battlements of the anti-globalization crowds and lots of G8 summits and others around the world. Who's winning that battle?
Well, I think it's very tough to keep score of something like this. I mean, corporate power, as we know, is still in ascendancy, and we see this most recently with the catastrophic oil spill, where the government once again seems helpless in the face of really doing its job of cleaning up this disaster, and is waiting for the corporation responsible for it to do its work. So, I mean, if we look at it, you know, on that sort of a scale, I think, you know, Goldman Sachs is doing fine, BP is doing fine. There's lots of evidence that the public sphere is weaker than ever, and the corporate sphere continues really to usurp the role that we consider traditional roles for government. But that said, I think that the suspicion of corporations and the critique of that corporate power over politics is much stronger today than it was when I published No Logo 10 years ago. I mean, 10 years ago, it was the height of the dot-com boom. Mm-hmm. And it was considered quite scandalous to have anything negative to say about these wonderful corporations that were expanding all over the globe. You know, that's certainly not the case today. The issue is whether people feel that they have the political power to change things at all. And, you know, you talked about those summits, the protests outside the World Trade Organization, mm-hmm. free trade deals. You know, I think it would be unfair to say that all of this was for naught. I mean, the World Trade Organization, which is really the institution that was globalizing the rules of the road, like privatization, deregulation of the financial sector, very, very tight controls over intellectual property. And this is why it was being targeted by these young people who started off campaigning against, say, Nike because of sweatshops, you know, or Shell because of its Shell Oil, because of its human rights record in Nigeria. Found themselves on the doorstep of the institutions that were writing the rules of the road. And looking back now, the World Trade Organization continues to be in crisis. They haven't been able to get a successful trade round going for many years, really since Seattle, with a little blip in Doha, where they, mm-hmm. they managed to use the tragedy of September 11th to bully countries to accept another trade round, but that immediately went off the rails. There's been a, you know, Latin America has elected governments that are overtly critical of what they call neoliberalism, which is the same policies of corporate rule. So I think some progress has been made.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour with Naomi Klein on the 10th anniversary of her breakthrough book, No Logo. It's out in a new edition with a big new introduction. She joins us from Toronto, Canada. Just to remind us how it works, here's a little ad from Starbucks. Came out late last year. It's a brand that often emphasizes the themes of community. Here's an ad part of their All You Need Is Love campaign.
We are divided by continents, countries, ethnicities, political parties, languages. What if we could erase those divisions? What if we all came a little closer together instead of moving a little further apart?
Naomi Klein, remind us just for a second, for heaven's sakes, what could be wrong with that?
Well, besides the fact that I've just become the excuse for NPR to air corporate advertising, I mean... These are wonderful ideas, and this is why I always feel ambivalent about the critique of lifestyle branding, because I find it encouraging that the highest priced market research that money can buy finds out that what people actually want is community, a sense of belonging, mm-hmm. that they're tired of division, that they want peace and love. Mm-hmm. The problem is they're not going to get it from a cup of coffee. They might get it if they joined a political movement and organized. But this the idea that this deep longing that I think we really do have is going to be satisfied at the mall, you know, is one of the most profound challenges that we face. And for me as a author activist, like I said, I feel ambivalent about it, because I feel like I feel grateful to Starbucks that they've done our market research for us. And, you know, to borrow a slogan from Coke, we should be offering the real thing instead of just complaining about them. But this is certainly part of what I was tracking in No Logo, which, you know, at 10 years later, we take for granted. But a decade ago, this was this new exciting trend in the world of marketing, where companies were having these revelations that they didn't have to be in the product business. This was the rhetoric mm-hmm. of these gurus like Tom Peters, that it was really old-fashioned companies that sold things like coffees and running shoes and cars. And the companies that would rule the future understood that they were selling an idea, a lifestyle, an identity, and that the products were really incidental. And so we got some really transcendent, inspiring marketing out of that revelation, from companies like Nike and Apple, and certainly Starbucks. But the flip side of this, and this is, you know, what I investigated, spent a lot of time investigating in No Logo, is that once companies decide that they are in the lifestyle business, in the ideas business, in the communication business, and not in the lowly business of producing stuff, then that means that they don't need to own their own factories, they don't need to offer their employees long-term contracts, and really what I was tracking in No Logo was a project of what I would call corporate transcendence from the corporeal world of things, and this attempt to really take flight. And these corporate epiphanies were hitting companies like Starbucks like thunderbolts from the heavens. You know, we are not a coffee company, we are about the idea of community, or Nike announcing we are not, you know, a sneaker company, we are about the idea of transcendence through sports. So on the one hand, you get this fantastic marketing, and you also get more invasive marketing, and they have to tag on to previously unbranded spaces like schools and arts festivals, things like that. But on the other hand, you have a much less stable workforce, and essentially these brands see themselves not as producers, but really as consumers themselves. They're scouring the globe for the cheapest possible contract that they can place within a web of contractors and subcontractors, where they will buy their product from that.
Sort of hovering above all the messy corporeal stuff and plucking from wherever they can and living inside big idea bubbles that are very, very appealing. You write in the introduction about how this became not just corporate policy, but really became, in many dimensions, U.S. government policy in this last decade.
Yeah, absolutely. And when I was writing my more recent book, The Shock Doctrine, one of the things that I was researching, what I look at in The Shock Doctrine, among other things, is how the U.S. government under the Bush administration really took advantage of the so-called war on terror and the invasion of Iraq to revamp the way in which the U.S. Wages war, and the way in which it guards its borders, treats security. All of it was contracted out. I mean, we know this now. Companies like Blackwater taking on functions that would have been unimaginable for a private company to take over. And reading speeches by Donald Rumsfeld in this period, I was really struck that he sounded a lot like Bill Gates did in the 90s. I mean, he was saying, you know, giving these speeches to the Pentagon, saying, you know, why is it that we clean our own military bases? Why do we cut our own checks? Why do we provide our own medical care? We have to have our core competency, and then we'll contract everything else out. And I think this really should be understood as the most lasting legacy of the Bush administration, which is treating government as the way these corporations treated their companies in the 90s, hollowing them out, subcontracting everything that they could possibly subcontract, and leaving this sort of a hollow shell. So it still looks like a government, it can still play a government on TV, but, you know, pull back the curtain and Halliburton and Bechtel and Blackwater and Lockheed Martin are performing all of the functions.
You say hollowing out, but we were spending more than ever under George W. Bush. With the recession and stimulus.
Absolutely. Spending more and contracting out was supposed to be more efficient, but actually it's tremendously costly. And what it is a boom to the private sector. And in a part of what I think should properly be understood not as free markets or capitalism, but really corporatism, the trading of favors between political and corporate elites. It's tremendously profitable for the companies that fund campaigns to be given these no-bid contracts. They, you know, this isn't the free market. They just have to, you know, apply for these contracts. In many cases, they don't have to compete for them. Their profits are built in, and it's a very nice arrangement if you can get a piece of it. But for taxpayers, it's enormously expensive. It's enormously inefficient, and we've seen this. I think we're seeing it right now with the BP disaster, with the oil spill. We saw it during Hurricane Katrina, where, you know, FEMA was such a hollow shell that they basically weren't even able to find the disaster zone, and then we were treated to endless stories of contractor fraud and abuse, just as we were in Iraq, just as we were in Afghanistan. We know these stories, but what I do, you know, in the new introduction for No Logo is put this phenomenon within this continuum of this logic of just getting out of the business of doing things and showing how it has infected the heart of government to tremendously unfortunate consequences.
You're right, and maybe irony of ironies, that the salvation for the U.S. at the end of this period you're writing about, or near the end of it, came in the form of what else? An enormous brand, maybe the biggest brand globally ever, Barack Obama.
Yeah, the marketing world was, you know, Barack Obama's biggest fan. The Association of National Advertisers before the election named Obama as the top brand in the world, beating out Nike, Apple, Coors, and Zappos. So, you know, it's not just me saying he's a super brand. The top brand managers in the world had tremendous admiration for the way the Obama campaign managed his brand. You know, I distinctly remember seeing that Will I Am video. Yes We Can video.
Black Eyed Peas, yeah.
and watching it going, wow, I actually just found it almost a relief that finally there was a politician who had advertisements as sort of inspirational and cutting edge as Nike did in the 90s. It had taken all of this time, but finally it was here. And, you know, I think there's just no doubt that the Obama campaign used, you know, viral marketing, you know, in incredibly clever ways, you know, user-generated content like Obama Girl, hired some, you know, one of the founders of Facebook. David Axelrod has a lot of experience working for corporations as well as politicians. And then Desiree Rogers, who's, you know, no longer with the White House, she got herself into trouble with her colleagues by proudly proclaiming that they had the best brand in the world in the form of Obama, and that the White House was their crown jewel, a sort of interactive branded space where they could, you know, really treating it the way a lot of these super brands in the 90s treated these sort of three-dimensional spaces is one of the things that I discuss in No Logo. Things like Celebration Florida, the Disney-branded town, mm-hmm, the place where it's not enough just to consume the advertising. You want to live your brand. And in a way, that's the way Desiree Rogers managed the White House, is this sort of nonstop 24-hour reality program for the adorable Obama clan. You know, I should say, you know, I wanted Obama to win the election. I'm not coming at this from the right, but I do think there is a very powerful cultural phenomenon that we need to understand that also explains why there's a little bit of buyer's remorse out there from many of the people who got swept away in the promise of Obama, where, you know, it had these qualities that all good marketing has, where that you are invited to project your deepest longings onto kind of a blank canvas, and you think that you know what you're getting because all of your emotions are being played with, you know, and your memories are being played with. I mean, the memory of the civil rights movement, the memory of the 60s, you know, using this sort of pop art that recalls Che Guevara, the Yes We Can is you know, a translation of Si Se Puede, the migrant farm worker slogan. And, you know, the cadence of Martin Luther King. But then so you think you know what you're getting. You think you're getting something that's really about change, as we know. But it's actually really, if you parse it, like all good marketing, the firm promise isn't made. You can't hold him to it because, in fact, he was very, very careful, as all good marketers are, not to make firm promises that he could be held to.
And you roll up your sleeves in this new intro on No Logo and really go after the president on that. You say that he may be the biggest brand in the world, but you write of President Obama, he favors the grand symbolic gesture over deep structural change every time. Proof?
The big announcement that we'll close Guantanamo, so you think, you know, this president stands firmly against torture, but then you find out, well, maybe he's not closing Guantanamo. He's certainly not closing Bagram. He's not prosecuting the Bush officials who are responsible for the torture memos and for essentially trying to legalize torture. So, yeah, the big symbolic gesture, the sort of marketing moment, but the nitty gritty isn't there. And the same was true around the rhetoric that getting tough on the banks and then sort of handing the reins over to Timothy Geithner and Larry Summers, two people who were personally responsible for creating the conditions of the meltdown. So, I think that there's a pretty strong track record for just the way in which he's just this incredibly effective mirror for people to imagine that, you know, that they are getting a version of themselves. But, you know, you say I'm very hard on Obama. I'm not that hard on Obama. I think he's very good at this. I think he's an incredibly savvy politician. And really, where the critique belongs is in the movement that brought Obama to power and that convinced themselves that they were leading a radical insurgency against the Democratic Party, you know, power base, and didn't demand things of their candidate, didn't demand firmer promises, firmer commitments, were constantly making excuses for him, and then failed to sort of declare their independence after the elections and be the pressure that Obama really needs, I think, to stand up to the incredible pressure he's under from the right. And so,
Naomi, if you'd hold the thought right there, we've got callers on right this point and have been holding them at bay. If I may go to a couple here. Ann Arbor, Michigan. Tim, you're on the air with Naomi Klein.
Hi, Tom. Great show. Thank you very much. Mm-hmm. Naomi, great career. Thank you very much. My question is, why the apparent great reluctance on the part of liberals to criticize Obama? I mean, and the reason why I ask that question is that I'm a Midwestern moderate to conservative urban Democrat who was glad to vote for Obama and contribute to his campaign, but I have been really disappointed. He seems to make no effort to expand the envelope of the politically possible, you know, like through any kind of incessant advocacy or anything like that. I mean, he really comes across as kind of a 21st century Uncle Tom. Now, I realize that is tough language, but that's really what I see. And I'm just a moderate Democrat. I don't consider myself a liberal. So why? Why the reluctance?
A 21st century Uncle Tom. Let's first get Naomi. Is that fair?
I really do not like that language. Sorry, Tim. Thanks for your kind words. But, you know, Uncle Tom has a really clear racial subtext or overtext,
or explicit text.
I think it's unnecessary. I think, you know, he's acting like a Democrat, and there's no need to racialize it. So I think your point is well taken, that there is a tremendous reluctance on the part of many people who were so inspired by the promise that Obama represented, the very real promise of change, particularly in the midst of the economic crisis. And we have to remember that, you know, Obama was losing the election. I mean, there was a real nail-biting moment in September of 2008 when Sarah Palin gave a big bump to the Republicans. They were pulling ahead, and we were actually looking at a McCain-Palin win. And it wasn't until, you know, Lehman collapsed and Obama found his sort of populist voice, and he started talking about how the economic crisis was the fault of a system of deregulation and giving more and more to the people at the top and not to the people at the bottom, and that he wanted a bottom-up bailout, and using rhetoric that's finally started resonating with working-class Americans, and that's when he won the election. And I think he should be held accountable to that rhetoric, even if it was only rhetoric and it wasn't specific promises. That really, really is what carried him to victory. But I think there's three factors for why we're not seeing more overt criticism of Obama from progressives. One is the fact that so many independent movements, like, for instance, the anti-war movement, groups like Move On, really allowed themselves to be completely absorbed into the Democratic Party machine during the election. And as I said before, they haven't declared their independence since. They're still kind of arms of the Democratic Party. So they don't have the leadership level, they don't seem to want to have the freedom to launch those gloves off critiques that the Obama administration deserves and I believe needs in order to have that momentum for change and to stand up to the pressure from the right.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour with supercritic of modern marketing and global capitalism, Naomi Klein, on the 10th anniversary of her breakthrough book, No Logo. She joins us today from Toronto, Canada. The book's out with a big new introduction by Klein. And let's get to callers. Mary in Peabody, Massachusetts. Mary, you're on the air with Naomi Klein.
Hi, thank you very much for taking my call. Mm-hmm. I have 2 points. I think she's being very tough on Obama, and I'm going to give 2 points why. One thing about marketing that's happened with Obama is the incredible lack of keeping your attention on anything and getting bored with it and moving on. Now, just a year ago, we had over 600,000 layoffs per month, and we had banks with 60% of our GDP about to fail. And when he was at, when he was campaigning, he said that was something he was going to do something about, and he did. He saved them. We had our GDP shrinking, and I think it, I don't remember the exact amount that it was shrinking, but it was far more than 6%, and it has now grown by 5.7%. So Obama has fought off what would have been the biggest calamity that we ever had. If we lost 60% of our GDP, what unemployment rate do you think we'd have? It certainly would not be 10%. It'd be more about 50%. Nobody's paying attention to that. They've all forgotten that as though that's something that, well, of course, that would have happened.
Mary, stick with us for a second. Naomi, what do you say to Mary?
Well, you know, as I was saying before, what Obama promised on the campaign trail was that there wouldn't be a top-down bailout, that there would be a bottom-up bailout. It's something absolutely needed to be done to deal with the meltdown on Wall Street. The question is, how do you go about it? And choices were made under the Bush administration that were carried out seamlessly by the Obama administration as well, to bail out those banks with no strings attached, to just... have a transfer of public money into private hands, absolutely unprecedented in nature, and make no demands of the banks that they keep homeowners in their homes, that they refrain from laying off workers. I mean, no demands were made. So you are having absolutely a rebound on Wall Street, and we're seeing the record bonuses coming back. But the layoffs are continuing, and the real crisis, and this is what I was saying at the time, that the problem with the way the bailout was being handled is that the crisis was being moved from a private sector debt crisis into a public sector debt crisis. So now you have the real, and this, you know, relates to my most recent book, The Shock Doctrine, of how economic crisis becomes the excuse to push through very, very unpopular policies that are incredibly harmful for regular working people. This crisis is not over. Now it is a public debt crisis at the federal level, but even more acutely at the state level. So who's really paying for the way in which this bailout was administered? It's, you know, students in California at the public universities facing a 32% tuition increase. Women who need women's shelters in California facing the prospect that their shelters are going to close. You know, the most vulnerable people in society actually are being forced to pay the price for the way in which this bailout took place. So the question is not, you know, was there going to be some response to the crisis? It was what kind of a response would it be? And I think Obama has absolutely betrayed his election promise to have a bottom-up bailout that would take care of, you know, Main Street as opposed to just Wall Street. Main Street is hurting, and this crisis is not over. Where there's new pressure to do away with Social Security, ideas that actually could not fly under the Bush administration. You remember George Bush went on his listening tour to try to sell the idea of privatizing Social Security, and people would have none of it. But now all these ideas are coming back. And they're not being sold on ideological grounds, because it's very hard to make an ideological case right now that Wall Street should be in control of your pension. But it's being sold on the grounds of, we have such a profound public debt and deficit crisis that we have no choice but to do away with so-called entitlements.
Mary, what do you say to that line of argument?
Well, first of all, she says the layoffs are still continuing. Can we please get some perspective here? We had over 600,000 people being laid off per month. I believe last month we had somewhere around 12,000.
But it is still 9.7% unemployment. I mean, you have to grant it's still high. Yes, not the same layoffs, but unemployment is still very high.
Well, if you imagine that you're walking up a hill and somebody comes and smacks you in the face and knocks you down the hill and you fall down half mile down the hill, it's going to take you a while to stop the momentum of you rolling down the hill. And then you're going to stop. Then you got to get yourself back up. And then you got to climb back up.
What about the argument that he should have climbed back up differently, Mary? What about the argument that there was a different way to respond?
I think that maybe there is a lack of grasp of the scope of the problem, because we had banks that had 60% of the GDP about to fail. I think there's many arguments that could be saying that maybe we should never have allowed six banks to have 60% or more of
indeed.
Our GDP. Mm-hmm. That is a valid argument. But at the point that you do, and you have net 30, and in net 30 those banks are going under, what are you going to do? You really think that you're going to have 60% of the GDP evaporate? And remember that the FDIC...
No one was suggesting that, Mary. Nobody...
$1,000. All of the businesses that have their banks and their money in those banks that are over $200,000, that money is gone. They're not going to have that money. How can you have something that massive fail, and you say, well, what are you going to do?
Mary, I appreciate your call very much. Naomi Klein, there was certainly talk, though, of dominoes here, big dominoes going down if there wasn't intervention.
I don't recall anyone arguing for no intervention. The question is what kind of intervention. I mean, if you're going to put $700 billion on the table, and actually it was more like $13 trillion mm-hmm. if you count the FDIC
open window,
guarantees,
yep.
the Federal Reserve loans, what sort of condition? How are you going to use that tremendous leverage? I mean, if there's one thing every banker knows, it's that when you're handing out a loan, you can put all kinds of conditions on that loan. If you ask the International Monetary Fund how it works, they'll explain to you very specifically. I mean, a country is in financial crisis. They come to the International Monetary Fund in Washington, and they get a list of conditions that come with their bailout, their loan. What the Bush administration started and the Obama administration continued, and they did not have to continue, was a no-strings-attached bailout. And so the problem that Mary has identified, and they're absolutely the case of, power concentrated into far too few hands, the prospect of dominoes falling, as you raise, we are still in that same situation. And arguably, we are in a worse situation because part of the way both the Bush administration and the Obama administration responded to the financial crisis was by loosening the controls on the banks that prevented them from merging with each other and growing even bigger.
Right.
So you've had a wave of mergers. The banks are still too big to fail. And we have lost that moment of leverage to push through robust financial regulation.
Rahm Emanuel said, never waste a crisis. You're suggesting it was wasted.
It absolutely was wasted, and not just the crisis, but also the Democratic mandate. Obama came to power with a decisive and inspiring Democratic mandate to rein in the banks and to have a bottom-up bailout. It wasn't an example of what I talk about in the shock doctrine of using a crisis to push through unpopular policies. These were popular policies. They had a mandate to do it, and they had the leverage, and they didn't use that leverage. The banks are back on their feet. They're using taxpayer money to pay their lobbyists to defeat every single sensible proposal that comes to Capitol Hill.
Even with the steps that President Obama's administration has taken, you've got, Tea Party folks all over the streets over this last year.
Yeah, and this comes back to Tim's point about why the progressives haven't been tougher on Obama. And I think part of the reason is that when you have this extreme response from the right and calling, Obama, a fascist and Hitler and all of this, it kind of makes you feel protective of the guy. But the problem is that this is just bad politics, because Obama is, if there's one thing we know about him, he's a centrist. He looks for the center in any political standoff, and he says, okay, we're going to compromise. That's fine as long as he's being pushed from two poles, not just from an extreme right pole, but also from a strong left pole. And that left pole isn't there. So, you look at where the compromises end up. Look at healthcare. If there had been a clear independent progressive movement in the United States that had been demanding single-payer healthcare, I don't think they would have gotten it, but I do think there would have been a public option as part of the compromise between the death panel pressure on the right and a really robust a movement demanding single payer on the left. And the left has to learn how to play this game, because Obama is a centrist, and that means you've got to move the center to the left.
Raise that voice, says Naomi Klein. That's the domestic picture. Jeff, in Andover, Massachusetts, you're on the air.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Mm-hmm.
I wonder if Naomi could revisit something that I was just thunderstruck by when I read No Logo, and she characterized the anti-sweatshop movement as roving and random. And, a handful of our groups had been focused on Nike like a laser beam for about 6 years at that point, and we actually hurt the company's sales. By the time the book was on the shelf, they had had their third year of falling sales in the United States, despite spending $500 million a year on advertising.
So you didn't feel roving and random. You felt focused and effective. Memories are long, Naomi. What do you say?
Yeah, I think that's probably a fair critique. I probably didn't choose those words wisely. I have a chapter of the book on just how incredibly effective the campaign that did take a laser-like a focus on Nike and use Nike to really educate a generation of young people about how the global economy actually worked. I mean, this was one of the things that was happening at that time, was that the idea of globalization and the global supply chain was relatively new. And you had a generation of activists that were used to politics exclusively in the national realm. You know how to lobby your congressperson. You know how to go after a company down the street. But the idea of a company using this global supply chain, I mean, how do you even go after that? And that's what the campaign that went after Nike did so amazingly well, by creating connections between particularly young people on campuses whose, say, their sports teams were sponsored by Nike, and introducing them to the Indonesian workers that were making the products that they were buying in their campus stores, and creating these networks of solidarity. So I have nothing but praise for the groups that were at the forefront of that movement, and they really opened the door, I think, to what became the so-called anti-globalization movement, which was really an anti-corporate movement that went after the World Trade Organization. But the context in which I wrote that sentence was the context of hearing from, I spent a lot of time visiting export processing zones in Indonesia, the Philippines, and Latin America. And one of the things that I heard from workers and their representatives was that they found that if the abuse was not being committed by a famous brand like Nike or Adidas, that they couldn't get any attention from the West, that it had to be a celebrity brand to get media attention, to get campaigner attention, to get journalistic attention as well. So I think the point that I was trying to make is that these brand-based campaigns that go after a Nike or go after a Shell or go after a McDonald's do an incredible job of getting the debate going, but we still need regulations across the board, because not every company is a super brand. And there's still going to be abuses. You might fix a company like Nike, or you might have a company like American Apparel that comes along and says, we're proud that we produce our clothing in L.A., but that isn't getting at the core of the problem, which is an industry-wide problem.
Are we any less free in our minds from that big brand power that you see as kind of, I don't know, the keystone at the top of a whole system here? And should we be? We talked with a professor of marketing at Duke, Gavin Fitzsimmons, before we talked to you, Naomi. He had some interesting observations. He said that they've done studies, and they found that the influence of brands can be, in some ways, positive. He said subliminal exposure to the Apple logo actually makes people more creative. The Speedo logo actually makes them run faster and believe they can. The Disney logo makes them more honest, he said they've found. What do you say?
Well, look, I haven't read those studies, so I can't comment on that. But, drove my critique, the reason why I decided to write No Logo all those years ago, is, not because I have a problem with, seeing the Disney logo or seeing the Speedo logo, but because this phenomenon of corporations deciding that they were lifestyle companies was having a profound effect on the public sphere itself, on places. There used to be some kind of a firewall between the public sphere and the corporate sphere, or even journalistically, some kind of a firewall between what we used to call journalism and what we now call content and advertising. And what I found is that as corporations decided that they weren't satisfied merely with marketing, they wanted to sell these complete lifestyles, that our public spaces were disappearing, that there were no spaces free of marketing. the one of the things I track is, you know, advertisements in the classrooms and of public schools and so on. So that was always my concern. It wasn't, you know, I hate seeing a logo. I mean, like I said, the no logo, the name of the book was a wink at being an anti, at being itself a logo, an anti-logo logo. But the real issue is, you know, I don't think that every space should be a space where we are sold to, you know, where corporate values dominate, that there should be spaces where other values dominate.
So we've just got a minute left. Let's come back to the first question I asked. 10 years on, do you think that perspective, the perspective you raised so potently there, has made progress in pushing back? Or have corporations, you know, I mean, the Supreme Court just ruled they can give anything to political campaigns. Have they actually gained ground on the mind share ownership?
You know, I think we're dealing with these trends that are taking place simultaneously, that yes, corporations are growing more powerful because of deregulation, and the Supreme Court decision is another manifestation of that, of taking away some protection, that's saying, you know, this is a space where corporations shouldn't dominate, and just getting rid of that of that distinction. But the response to that Supreme Court decision, the outrage at that Supreme Court decision, is also instructive and shows that actually I think there is a much deeper critique of the way in which corporations have taken over our political process in particular. And the question is, how are people going to organize? How are they going to mobilize in response to that? Because having the critique is not enough.
Naomi Klein's 10th anniversary edition of No Logo is just out. Naomi, thank you very much for joining us this hour. Come and talk with us again.
That was really fun. Thanks, Tom.
Listeners, you can continue this conversation, get the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org, or follow us on Twitter or Facebook at On Point Radio. On Point is produced by Julie Jopp, Sam Gale Rosen, Ping Wong, Eileen Amata, Stefano Katsonis, Hillary McQuilkin, James Ross, and John Wibby. Our senior producer is Karen Schiffman. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.